Next case is Townland versus the Commonwealth. Is Edward Jeffrey? Apparently not Mr. Jeffrey. Mr. Jones. Has everybody signed the sign-in sheets?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Tomlin, excuse me, you are not Ms. Tomlin. Ms. Edwards, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve, although you're responsible for keeping track of your own time, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes.
You may begin when ready.
Thank you. May it please this court, I am Connie Louise Edwards here on behalf of Michelle Tomlin. And four issues were raised in our brief. The first one addresses the court's amendment, the Commonwealth court allowing the Commonwealth to amend several indictments right at the beginning of trial. There was an issue about where the judge spoke and said, well, if they change the nature, you might have a chance at a continuance. Now, Ms. Tomlin's counsel at trial, Ms. Stanton, did point out to the judge that he had said previously that this matter wasn't going to be continued. It had already been continued several times. However, at that point, he said it was conditional. You know, if it changes the nature, you might have a chance for a continuance. So then they go through.
Why does it change the nature, though? The Supreme Court in Sullivan and Rawls, this court in Dunaway, basically have been pretty clear that if just because the maximum amount of punishment might change, that doesn't change the nature and character of the indictment. And here, the original indictment talked about obtaining signatures, and it was changed to obtaining money by false pretenses. So you've simply gone from the means of making it happen, I guess is the way to say it, the obtaining the signatures on the checks, to obtaining the money, the checks. So why is that? It's the same statute. Why does that prevent Ms. Tomlin and counsel, Ms. Stanton, from being aware of what they needed to defend against?
It is under the same statute, and to the first about Dunaway and the other series, I would argue that I think in the majority of those cases, at least specifically in Dunaway, that the maximum punishment did not change. It was the mandatory minimum sentence that changed. And so in this case, the argument is that indeed it changed the maximum amount of punishment that was available by changing its statutory...
It was a mandatory minimum there, but in Sullivan and Rawls, I don't think it was.
It may not have been. But
isn't the key in the case law, well, it doesn't matter that any of the elements of the invention... What? Obviously, the actual proving the signature is different than proving money, but we all understood that it was these transactions, the same conduct, the character of the offense hadn't changed. It was still acquiring something by deceitful means on these dates in these transactions. I mean, it seems to me everything is exactly the same, except instead of proving a signature, all I have to do is prove the Commonwealth is now charged with proving money.
Well, Your Honor, it does change the elements, because when you go from the signatures, that's what's being offered up until the date of trial, and then it backs up and says the money. So then you have to be prepared for along the stage anywhere and anything that could constitute a false representation or what is required, and then the timing of when it occurs is also very relevant. And so to be able to argue and evaluate the evidence through the whole process in light of what the complaint is, and to be prepared then to focus on a different time, because in a false pretense case...
But the conduct that was subject to the charge, whether it's money or signatures, everybody understood what the transactions at issue were. It wasn't like all of a sudden the transactions with the residents of the home or Walmart all of a sudden became new things, those were always what was being investigated and being charged, correct? I mean, the transactions themselves.
No, the transactions did not change. They were the same transactions. I'm arguing that they changed the character and the
name. So then the timeline is the same too, isn't it? Because if it's these transactions on these dates, it's the same. It's the same conduct. There was no surprise regarding conduct.
As of the events that were involved, I would agree with Your Honor that it's the same series of conducts. What changes is the counsel's ability to adequately prepare for the wider span of conduct that suddenly might come into play, because when previously it was focused on the signatures, and any false pretense would have had to have occurred before that, and the money being obtained.
With the evidence,
and I think that does still apply. It has to occur before the money being obtained. Yes, ma'am?
Would the evidence change at all?
Your Honor, I can't say for sure. I don't think it changed from what it would have been, regardless of whether they proceeded on the signatures or the monetary concept. But I guess my argument is it does change the potential punishment, though we have the two cases that Judge Beals has indicated did say, and I accept that, that it wasn't related to just a mandatory minimum. The nature of the case changed because even though the conduct is same, it's the focus broadens, and the preparation time was used to prepare for what had been presented, and then the preparation time for the other was not available anymore because they were right at trial. If I may, I'll move on to another point. The second point raised was the motions to strike. And we have three different charges. We have the false pretenses charges, and we have the embezzlement charges, and then we had one grand larceny charge. And I would argue to this court that Ms. Tomlin prevails on this argument on all three aspects. First of all, regardless of changing from the signature to the cash, the false pretense must occur at the time of the obtaining of the money or prior. And it has to be supported by a false representation of an existing fact or past event. And there was nothing in this record that showed any false pretense that enticed the fund to representatives to give over the money. Well, there's no false representation.
Well, given the timeline and how quickly things are done, and that they're done repeatedly over multiple times, and the pattern appears to be exactly the same, why can't a rational fact finder conclude that from the very beginning of each transaction that this was her intent from the very beginning? And if it is, and if that's a rational conclusion, doesn't that satisfy the false pretenses at or before the acquiring of the money?
No, sir.
Only if she changed her mind about what was going to happen in the course is the timing of the false pretense at issue. If she had the same intent throughout the transaction, from getting the list from the person at the home and had always intended to do what she did and make copies of the receipts and do all of that, if she believed that all the way through, there's no problem with the charge, is there?
Yes, sir, there is.
Okay, why?
And I will tell you why. Intent is one element, and the false pretense is a totally separate element. Now, they do have to coexist at the beginning, but that is coexistence. That's not unity in being. So there are two different elements. It's the element of intent, and then there's the actual false pretense. So something that is represented has to indeed be false.
But if her intent from the beginning is I go and the person tells me they want a TV or a TV is on their list, and then I go and would get money from the account to go buy them a TV, but no, at that time, I'm never giving them a TV, and I'm keeping the money. Why isn't that a false pretense when I ask for the money to purchase the TV for that person when I have no intention of them ever getting the TV?
Your Honor, I do not concede that she had that content. intent. Okay, I do not concede that.
But assume the fact finder has concluded that, and that that's a reasonable conclusion from the evidence. If you assume all of that, and I know you don't, but I'm asking you to accept that. If you accept that, why is that not sufficient?
It's not sufficient because there has to be a false representation. That is an element independent of itself.
Isn't there an implicit representation when you were withdrawing money from the person's individual account to buy them a TV that you are going to, in fact, buy them a TV and give it to them? Not buy a TV, take it back to the store, and keep the money for myself.
Your Honor, the evidence established that the cost is what's represented, and the money was provided, and that evidence was submitted that indeed the residents did receive the items that were purchased. Now, subsequently, there's evidence that on four of the occasions, I believe it was, they did go back to the store, and some in a relatively quick time.
Within 4 hours.
4 hours, yes, sir.
Where is there evidence in the record that resident actually received that TV? It would have been very brief.
Well, it was the document, Your Honor, that was signed and part of the record that's before this court by the resident. The resident shopping list, that was signed by the individual that received it.
That's evidence that the resident wanted the item, not evidence that the resident received it.
No, sir. No, ma'am. I beg to differ.
All right.
It substituted for both, or it stood for both, that they were had requested the item and that they had received it.
Do you get that from the document?
That's what was explained from the policy by the witnesses, Ms. Seeley and Ms. Little. And I would just say Ms. Little was explaining a little bit about why it went back to the store, because when I first read this case, to me it hit me. The residents can't get to their money because it's in this account. And you have the Medicare issue that Ms. Little raised, that they can't have so much money in that account, and they're allowed to use that account to buy things. And also that they have desires to utilize their money for, like, family members or to support things like community baseball teams or who knows what. Because I'm going now to the larceny charge, which I think there's absolutely no evidence of a larceny.
You may use your time however you want, but you're significantly into your report.
I am significantly over my... I'm going to try to do 24 seconds. But I would just simply say, looking at the practicality of this, these individuals could not have so much money in those accounts. The lady was answering and explaining why monies would be taken off, and I will say Ms. Stanton actually cut her off. But I think the logic of it, too, because going to the grand larceny, the gentleman bought 19 shirts in varying sizes. I think like something like 10 or 12. I can't remember exactly. It was small. A couple were large. Two were extra large, and one was a double X. But anyway, obviously there was no idea that he was buying all of those shirts for himself. And the only thing that is set forth to support that charge is when the lady went and looked in a room a year later, those shirts were not there. There's no indication those shirts were taken back. And they made a big thing about the copies of receipts. When you've got three or four people on a receipt, everybody gets a copy.
For his family members, I mean, obviously they're not going to all fit him because they were anywhere from medium to extra, extra large. But why couldn't he want them for his family and then they were never provided? Therefore, you have grand larceny.
Because you don't have any evidence that they were provided. You actually have evidence that they were provided by the signed shopping list. So there is nothing in the grand larceny case that indicates anything wrong. The only thing I think is there is because when she looked a year later, they weren't there, and who would have expected them to be there? I've got under 2 minutes, if I may step back.
Mr. Jones, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Jones for the Commonwealth. We are asking the court to affirm Tomlin's convictions, first because the evidence was sufficient to support all of the convictions, second because she was not entitled to a bill of particulars or to force the Commonwealth to elect between charges, and third because there was no problem with the amendment of the indictments on the morning of trial. So just to respond quickly to the amendment of the false pretense indictments, you know, the court has already hit on this, that the conduct that was charged didn't change, and that's the central inquiry whenever you're looking at whether an amendment changed the nature and character of the offenses. It doesn't focus on the punishment. It doesn't really focus that closely on the elements. It focuses on the conduct that was criminal, and that obviously did not change. So there was absolutely no problem with the amendment. And furthermore, to the extent that, you know, assuming or that there might have been a problem, the remedy for that would have been a continuance. And Tomlin's counsel specifically said, no, you already said you're not going to give us a continuance. Well, in light of changed circumstances, the court had just 10 seconds ago said, well, maybe I would give you a continuance if this works to a surprise. So to the extent that there might have been a problem, she rejected the only remedy that there should have been for that.
And during that colloquy, didn't indicate what the surprise would be because we're dealing with the same conduct.
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor. So moving on to sufficiency. On the false pretense issue, it is true that the false representation has to occur before obtaining the goods, but I believe that the court has already hit this as well, that given the evidence of intent that it was present throughout, given the repeated pattern of conduct, any representation that she made to get that money in the first place with that existing intent is going to be fraudulent. It's basically Ms. Tomlin saying, I'm going to go and buy a TV for this person. Can I have a cash advance? She intended not to give them the TV, so that's a false representation at that point. The patient shopping list, when they are submitted with the patient's signatures on them, that's another false representation because you have, as the court noted, within 4 hours in one instance, going back and returning the item immediately, and then the money goes into her account. No refund is ever given to the patient.
If there was a bigger gap in time, would the Commonwealth's case be more difficult? Because the larger the gap in time, it seems to me, gives an opportunity for a change of heart, a change in mind, a change in purpose.
Potentially, but I think even with even if that were the case, with the repeated pattern of conduct, that would really foreclose any kind of challenge along those lines, assuming you still have 5 instances of this general pattern occurring. It's pretty obvious. You know, if you have one of these, maybe she stumbled into it. Maybe she had a change of heart halfway through, but time and time again, each subsequent act, I think, strengthens the conclusion that there was a fraudulent intent the whole time.
The 5 that we're looking at today are between July 2011 and June 2012. Is that right?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes. So moving on to the larceny, counsel made the contention that there is no evidence except for the fact that 1 year later they went and checked Robert Jones's room and did not find the shirts. I would say that's an overstatement. There is evidence in addition to the lack of shirts being in his room. Initially, Ms. Tomlin made the order in her own name with her own personal address. Also, neither the nursing home nor Robert Jones had ever done business with this retailer before, but Tomlin had. And then, you still have that that pattern of conduct that's lurking there as well that I think pushes this over the line to make the conclusion that the trial court made a reasonable one based on the evidence. So
on the grand larceny, how do you respond to Ms. Edwards' argument there that there was never... I thought initially the argument was that they never went to him in the first place, so how could it be grand larceny? But my sense of the argument today, and I'll let her answer this when she comes back too, is no, they did. There's no indication they didn't, and there's no indication that he didn't then disperse them to whoever he wanted them to go to.
My reading of the record is that he never received them. That was my understanding, that to the extent that the patient shopping list indicated otherwise, that
so if he signs probably the patient fraudulent. Shopping list, does that mean he's received them or that he just...
That would be some them? Evidence that he had received them, but in...
Not just that he'd ordered them then.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be some evidence, but it was up to the fact finder to resolve inconsistencies between the evidence, and it did so against Tomlin. There really is no evidence that he had actual receipt of those shirts or that they were used for for their stated purpose when Tomlin obtained them. So,
and the shopping lists have many, many things on them from many different patients, and some seem to have signatures. Some, it's very difficult to tell if there's a signature.
That's true, Your Honor, and you know that was before the trial court. That probably goes to the weight of the patient shopping lists and you know how conclusive they are in establishing any fact at issue. But there was much better evidence suggesting that these were wrongfully procured.
The Connell's argument is on the grand larceny is that there's no evidence he ever got them.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the Commonwealth's position, and that the aspartation was by Jones's constructive possession, that because his money was used to purchase the shirts, they were his, and then Tomlin's failure to deliver them was the necessary aspartation. On the bill of particulars issue, the argument was not preserved. There was no transcript of the argument over the bill of particulars or the motion for election. So I would argue that it's not properly before this court under Rule 5A, colon 8. But to the extent that the court feels obligated to, or feels that it might be something that needs to be responded to, the bill of particulars, again, this gets back to whether Tomlin was properly on notice of the nature and character of the offenses by the indictments as they...
Is whether to grant a bill of particulars a question of fact or a question of law?
It's in the discretion of the trial court.
Well, there are cases from the Supreme Court dealing with whether you needed a transcript of a demurrer hearing, because a demurrer is decided by the court as a legal matter. Mm-hmm. And the answer has been that a transcript is not necessary for a demurrer hearing because the court can look at the motion itself and make a determination of what the arguments are. And obviously, you could always argue, well, maybe they conceded something at the demurrer hearing, but the Supreme Court seems to say that you don't need a transcript for that. Why doesn't that logic apply to the motion for a bill of particulars?
Well, Your Honor, we have no knowledge of what was presented to the trial court in that argument, so it's difficult to determine whether the trial court erred on the basis of the record before the court now. Perhaps, and that's what
there
I've tried to...
There are pleadings, though.
Yes, Your Honor, there are pleadings.
So we do know something.
Yes.
We know they asked for one.
They asked for one, that is true. And so to the extent that that necessitates evaluating on its merits, you know, we have responded to that on the merits as well. So on the merits, the bill of particulars was not necessary because the indictments put Tomlin on notice of the nature and character of charges against her. Kind of covered that in the amendment as well, but it was true of all the indictments. And then as far as election was concerned, there wasn't a double jeopardy problem here. That seems to be her argument on appeal, that there's a double jeopardy problem. Additional
the false pretenses in the offense.
Yes, Your Honor. But the additional problem with that is that that also was not presented to the trial court, and it's not appropriate for...
But on the merits, the embezzlement is getting the advance, and the false pretenses is keeping the money afterwards.
That is definitely a good way to cut it down, Your Honor. Yes. And again, there are separate evils that are punished as well, even if you take it back and don't look at them as separate acts. There's no multiple punishment problem because there's different elements in embezzlement than in false pretenses. They're not lesser included offenses of each other, and they get at separate evils. One is the abuse of a position of trust to steal money. The other is lying to acquire money. So there's just no multiple punishment problem there either. For the remainder of my argument, unless there are other questions, I would just rest on my brief.
Thank you
very much.
Ms. Edwards, your rebuttal time.
Yes. Thank you. Your Honor, I would just like to say embezzlement and false pretenses are mutually exclusive. I understand what you're saying, look at one time, then look at it the other time. But I'm going to argue to the court, and I think this is the base of this case, the type of relationship that is required to support an embezzlement statute conviction does not exist in this case. There were three people between Tomlin and that account. The business manager, the two people who had to sign the check, along with that was the procedure that applied. She had no direct relationship with that account.
But she received the money as a result of her employment, did she not?
She.
But for her employment, she would not have been able to receive the money.
Just being the employee of the facility does not.
But and
it does not an embezzlement make. It does not fit the requirements.
Isn't
there
she
are many,
an employee with a matter of trust, just like the people writing the check, because she's handling the money? The check is then made to her to make the purchase.
Well, it might be a level of trust at a certain point, but it is not the level of trust that's required by this statute. If you look at this statute and the cases under this, you have a special position and relationship. Like with Gwatney, the lady's behind the counter. That's the one with the bank teller, and she stole from somebody else's drawer. She tried to argue it was just her drawer. The court said, no, you're in that position physically, i.e. behind that counter, and therefore have access to these other places. That's the type of situation that this statute addresses, that special relationship. And the false pretenses requires totally different factors. So you don't need false. If you've got the trust relationship or the employment that gets you to that point.
If you have entirely different factors, though, that goes to Mr. Jones's point that there's not any type of double jeopardy problem, correct?
Well, Your Honor, that may support that position, but I'm going to simply say this. You can't have both. And that's my point, because on the facts in this case, you either have the employment relationship that is supporting their theory, which you don't have, or you need to have the false representations or pretenses. And that's the method by which you get the money. They don't have that either, I argue. But you've got to have the different factors, and one is mutually exclusive to the other. You can't have two different methods of getting the same money. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was going the other way. I apologize. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
It wasn't going to count up to 50.
It was going to keep going.